Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Food and Psych Podcast, where I, Kimberly Wilson, chartered psychologist and amateur food anthropologist, take you through all things food and psychology. Now, this episode was a real indulgence for me. One of the most fascinating things about being a psychologist is understanding how our daily struggles, whether that's our romantic relationships or our social groups or even our political beliefs, emerge from our evolutionary history. And for me, that's important because I think to understand where we are and where we're going, we have to have a clear sense of where we've come from. So it was a real pleasure to get a little time with evolutionary biologist Heather Hying. Heather is a scientist, educator, and author who earned her PhD in biology from the University of Michigan, where she earned the university's top honour for her dissertation. On top of that, she has a BA in anthropology, which is a study of human societies and behaviour. Heather has researched the evolution of social systems across a range of different organisms, including humans, and her book, Antipode, is based on her experiences in Madagascar while she was studying, of all things, the sex lives of poison frogs. In 2017, she resigned from her tenured professorship at the Evergreen State College, where for 15 years she provided undergraduates with an evolutionary toolkit with which to understand what it is to be human and how to be critical, engaged citizens of the world. There, she also designed courses that prioritised the scientific method and pushed students outside of their own certainty and comfort zones, something I am very big on. And this is what we get into most of all, the relationship between safety and risk, the growing attack on science, and how you can improve your critical thinking skills. I loved this episode. I could have spoken to Heather for hours and hours and hours, and I hope you enjoy it too. Heather, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me. I really, really appreciate it.
I am thrilled to be talking to you, Kimberly.
Thank you.
It's really an honour.
And on the Food and Psych podcast, we start each Breaking Bread episode by sharing my guests' meaningful food, and you sent me your recipe. I made it this afternoon, but for the sake of the audience, can you explain what it is and why it's meaningful to you?
Sure. Let's see, what I sent to you was the Venezuelan green sauce, is mm-hmm. that right?
Yes.
So it is not a sauce that my family and I have run into in our travels, although Venezuela is adjacent to where we spent a fair amount of time in Ecuador, and my husband and I have spent a lot of time in Latin America in general. It is a simple, delicious sauce with cilantro as its base, as opposed to the sort of standard Venezuelan green sauce that people think of, chimichurri, which is parsley as its base. So it's a mixture of olive oil and cilantro and garlic and onion and green and a little bit of green pepper, all pureed together. And I will make it in very large batches so that we always have some on hand. And it goes amazingly beautifully with just about any meats, vegetables, carbs, really anything. But my favorite way to eat it is after we have a steak dinner, I'll make sure to have bought a bit of extra steak. And the next day we'll slice that steak thinly and fry it up in a pan with butter and some thinly sliced red and green bell peppers, and have that steak and peppers over rice with a tremendous amount of green sauce on it. And it's just one of these meals that my family and I, my husband and my two boys and I, have come together around very often. You know, we tend to have many, many meals together. And at least until very recently, we're cooking almost all of our meals at home, which is wonderful, right? It is the way to come to know each other and to trust each other and to be prepared to push back against, you know, ideas that you don't like or emotions that feel awkward to you when you are, you know, literally breaking bread together, as you well know. So that is one of many foods that feels near and dear to my heart.
You've kind of centered it around the kitchen table, and are those kind of shared meals an important part of that bonding time and that discussion time for you and your family?
Absolutely. You know, it is both cliche and true. Right? So, you know, it feels maybe a little bit awkward to pronounce something that is already well pronounced out there in the world, but if anything, I think it's one of these things that people know is true and yet still have a hard time arriving at. Like, it's increasingly, with all of the demands on time and attention in particular, you know, I think we have more demands on our attention than we do on our time. And almost everyone talks a lot about, oh, I just don't have time, I'm so busy. Well, this is more about draws on your attention than actually legitimate pulls of your time. And so having at some level forced the issue of, we will sit and eat together because either I or we cook this together. You know, it's far easier to, if you order food in, for instance, to say, okay, well, you're not ready yet, I'll just eat because I'm hungry and it's hot, and so I'll eat now, and if you eat in 15 minutes, that's fine. And that, of course, you still get the calories you need, but you don't get the, well, dare I say, you know, this is your wheelhouse, but you don't get the psychological sustenance when you eat that way. And so when you do cook at home, you know, it's very much harder for anyone in your family, in your group, in your friend group, whoever it is you're eating with, to say, you know what, I'm not really ready yet. I'll eat later. I'll grab something later. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what? I did this. I cooked this thinking of you, thinking of us. I filled the home with the smells of food that we're about to eat. This is an integral experience, and now we will sit. And actually, in my family, we have a somewhat joking, but a thing that we do at the beginning of every meal, which obviously emerges from a little bit of a spoof I don't even know what the language is, but would it be the Lord's Prayer that people say at the beginning of meals?
Grace, yes.
And so, you know, we're not religious, but we're not anti-religious either. But, you know, we don't have any faith ourselves as a family. Mm-hmm. But I'll say to my family at the beginning of the meal, would you like to say a few words? And the idea is that they actually, at dinner, we each have to say literally three words that are disconnected from one another, that only have a noun present in the room. And if anyone uses a word that someone at the table doesn't know, they have to be able to define it. And so in this way, we sort of embark on like this stream of consciousness, free association, what words are in your head right now? And if one of the adults usually uses a word that one of the kids doesn't know, we have to define it. And it almost always starts some conversation that goes in some unexpected way, you know, that isn't exactly what we thought we might be talking about when we sat down. Mm. So that's a fun way to begin sharing our food as well.
That's great. And I feel like I need to pre-warn you now that, yes, we're certainly in my territory. And I love that we've gone there, because one of the things that I keep trying to convey a lot over social media, certainly with clients, is that food and feeling, affection, emotion, relationship go hand in hand, that they are intimately entwined, and we all have an emotional relationship with food. And certainly in terms of kind of individual psychology, that comes down to the idea that, of course, our first relationships are mediated through food. So, you know, the baby at the breast is also in the mother's arms. It's in the mother's gaze, in the mother's mind. And that is intimately wound up with the feeding experience. But yes. Your story also reminds me of the idea of campfires. and that sense that essentially, you know, in terms of the neurology, the when we're eating, it's because we're safe. You know, we're in a communal space, we're together. So there is something again about that experience of eating and communal eating, which is an extension of the idea of safety, of community, you know, that I, if I'm safe, it's because I'm around people who care for me or will protect me.
Oh, this is so good. It's so true. And this, you know, this is the sort of original honorable meaning of safe, where we, you know, we want safety so that we can take risks, right? Mm-hmm. So that we can extend beyond our own boundaries of what we've experienced before, what we, you know, including, you know, physical boundaries and mental boundaries, mm-hmm. you know, explore ideas, explore places, explore time in ways that we haven't before. And so I'll jump on with that, extend beyond my family. When I taught undergraduates for 15 years, I would run field trips every quarter, actually. Some of them extended. Some of them, you know, the longest one was an 11-week exploration through mm-hmm. Ecuador with my family. My husband and I were co-teaching this program, and our two boys and 30 undergraduates. So some of them went extraordinarily long, but every single quarter, pretty much, we spent at least 5 days somewhere in the American Pacific Northwest. Maybe in the eastern scab lands of Washington or up in the San Juan Islands at these, you know, somewhat rustic state park run areas called environmental learning centers, which always had commercial kitchens. Mm. And so we had a budget that came from student funds, which I would divvy up and dole out to groups of students who had figured out among themselves what teams they wanted to be on, and they would shop and cook and prepare, you know, at least one, sometimes two, depending on the trip, mm-hmm. Meals for everyone. And then we would together, all of us, eat all of the food that that they had cooked for us. And, you know, it was educational, just mm-hmm. every regard. And then very, very often after dinners, you know, not every night of a field trip, and some, you know, weather permitting, we would go out and we would sit around the campfire. And does that look like education? You know, is that a college education? Or yeah, you know, it is. Not only because we actually were, Brett and I, when we were teaching together, or, you know, me alone, if I was teaching alone, actually also talking about evolution and such around the campfire. But even when we weren't, what we were doing was we were creating community, and we were creating actual basis for trust. And once you have that, and food helps, once you have that, you can then push on people's ideas that they have with gentleness and with respect, but they're very much less likely to react with like terror or bile or imagine, you know, this is the conflation that almost everyone does. Imagine that if you disagree with me, you are advertising that you don't like me. Yes. And, you know, that's not the case, right? We should be able to disagree with one another and still hold great affection for one another.
Mm, definitely. There's something, we have this, what's happening, I think, or what I see happening is this weird fusion between disagreeing with my ideas and dismissing me as a person. And it, obviously that position kind of sets up this hostility where if I have to defend my ideas because my ideas form part of my identity, and if you attack my ideas, then you're attacking me, and therefore we can't see eye to eye. And it's, you know, because this is my day job is ideas. It's helping people to understand the validity and the veracity of their own thinking and their own ideas, to understand the meaning of them in present day context and historical context, but also to reality test them and to have them challenge their own thinking. I think sometimes people get the idea that therapy is a bit of a soft touch and we're just there to help people feel good about themselves and tell them that they were right all along. But actually, good therapy, not at all. You know, good therapy is about a challenge of ideas. And I wonder, I mean, obviously you've been in a particular position around ideas and ideology, and I've been trying to work out what's gone wrong. And I think maybe I've got a little kind of a couple of stories, a couple of ideas. So for example, there was somebody on social media, and they're a very popular influencer, feminist, kind of women's empowerment influencer. And they made a comment on their own page saying, fantastic, finally women are going to not care anymore about what men think of them, and they won't be trying to, something like, we won't be trying to compete for men's affection. Well, and so I said, well, you know, that's a nice idea, essentially, but it's not that simple, because if we think in evolutionary terms about sexual selection, there's always going to be a pressure for males and females to compete with each other and for the other's attention. And I was shut down. I was very much slammed down. And I was told, A, that I was trying to derail the argument, and B, that competition between women is only an effect of internalized misogyny. And
the patriarchy.
And I was kind of startled. And I think I was startled partly because I've spent so long working in a bubble where we sit around and talk about everybody's ideas in context and challenge them with compassion, but also with rigor. But I was really taken back, I think, by three things. So one was just the unwillingness to engage with an alternative viewpoint, which I find quite frightening. The second thing was the conviction of their own position. Just absolutely, I'm right, you're wrong. I'm an internalized misogynist. There's, you know, feel sorry for me. Which was, again, quite striking. And then the final thing was just the absolute disregard for the biology, for the science. Mm-hmm. There's lots of places we can go with that.
There's so many places, and I mean, I'm probably going to need to be prompted to remember all of them. But let's see, to your second point about how entrenched they were in their position, and you know, I think we've all seen this at this point. It sounds like you've seen it up close and personal in a way that it was a personal attack, and I certainly have as well, several times. But you know, I'm no longer a professor, in part because it came to my college and made these sorts of really entrenched and immovable demands on reality, in fact, right? So I think one of the things that I and many others have been saying that I think falls on deaf ears because it's not understood as where it's coming from by many of the new ideologues is, this looks like an attack on science. This looks like an attack on Enlightenment values of rigor and logic. And yes, of course, we need to do everything that we're doing with compassion and respect, but logic and rigor are going to help us understand what's true in the world. And so when ideologues, when people who are feeling righteous about their position and cannot back down from it or can't even imagine a reason why they should really hear that, I think they again think, yes, patriarchy and you know, old white guys, and the old white guys having, you know, produced most of the, you know, Western canon of science until very recently is true, but it was also done via the scientific method. And you know, that is the thing that I think is missing, and what I was able to teach effectively for many, many years, which is that actually science is the tool, the scientific method, wherein we make observations and we generate hypotheses that might explain those observations, and then we try to generate the predictions that would be true if those hypotheses were true. And then, and this is maybe the most important point, we try to falsify them. We try as hard as we can to prove ourselves wrong. We had an idea, what would be true? What could show up right now or at any moment, you know, from any place, from our own research, from friends, from enemies, from anyone, that would force us to say, huh, okay, falsified, I was wrong. And that is the scientific method. And scientists have to learn to feel good about that outcome. Like, hey, success, I was wrong. And I mean, that's actually so counterintuitive. And to me, that creates a kind of compassion for being wrong and an understanding of the value of being wrong, and an understanding, too, of this thing that both of us have touched on already, which is that your ideas and who you are not the same thing, even if your ideas form part of who you identify as. So,
I wonder, because the being wrong one is a big one, isn't it? And I wonder whether, and this is partly speculation, kind of thinking aloud, but I wonder whether, in part at least, there's something about the education system that makes us very fearful of being wrong, because it certainly strikes me that much of education is outcome over process, isn't it? It's, we need you to get the right answer, and almost we don't really, other than a little bit of showing you're working, you know, if you get the right answer, that's what we're interested in. And there's much less emphasis on the process by which you come to an outcome and the value and maybe pleasure or interest or curiosity in that process, irrespective of the outcome almost.
Yeah, that boy, again, there's so much there. You know, I know much less about the British educational system than I do about the American educational system, but I can assure you that the American education system is really messed up. And it doesn't have to be this way. But in part, what is going on is that, and you use this word, is that people are, you know, people, teachers are overworked and they have too many students and there are too many regulations about what they need to accomplish. And so it's, you know, teachers are being told it's about outcomes in terms of test scores as well as students.
Sure.
So I'm not trying to put the blame, you know, only on teachers here. But one of the things that I've seen teachers at every level, you know, K-12 and higher ed, both, and I have more experience watching it in higher ed, but my own children have been through, you know, a lot of schooling in the earlier years, is that people teach through fear. They use fear as a tool with which to control students in classrooms. And there is almost, I mean, again, we're right in your wheelhouse as a psychologist, but there's almost nothing more guaranteed to get people to shut down and not engage and not take risks.
How do you mean teach through fear? Sorry. Do you have an example?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are appalling examples, but more often it's subtle. Mm-hmm. And it is about the authority of the teacher to make decisions, which, you know, pretty much all students, once they're of a certain age, can watch teachers making decisions based on who they prefer at the moment, and who they prefer at the moment may well be based on who's agreeing with them most. Having assignments be busy work rather than actually exploratory creative projects, and any objections are met with hostility. In part this emerges from, again, even the best scientists, who are supposed to be all the time working hard to prove themselves wrong, and therefore if they have any number of ideas at all will with some regularity prove themselves wrong and therefore have to live in that experience of being wrong, everyone has a hard time being wrong. It's just, it's not the preferred state of being. And so what I've seen too often is faculty who walk in with maybe not knowing as much as they should, honestly, but also having a confidence issue, and using the authority of their degree or their position, the fact that they're the ones standing in the front of the room and the students are the ones sitting in chairs in nice, neat rows, to effectively say, if you disagree with me, it's because you don't get it. It's because you're wrong, and, you know, including implying, I've seen, you know, it's probably because you're stupid. More often, it's because you didn't do the work. Right. And so using the authority of a degree to shut people's inquiry and creative process down is anti-educational, but it happens all the time in supposedly educational settings.
It's also kind of anti-human, though, isn't it? I mean, if curiosity is an innate part of human beings, and this is where you'll have more to say on this, you know, that evolution, our movement as a species across the planet, the development of civilization is about our curiosity to know how and why, then the kind of shutting down of curiosity is kind of immoral, isn't it?
Yes, I wouldn't hesitate to use that word. Yeah, it is immoral. And you know, children aren't born, don't, you know, come of age at, I don't know, it depends on what you're talking about coming of age, but, you know, children don't emerge in 18 months and 6 years and 12 years and 18 years, you know, knowing the scientific method. But I have used a shorthand for years and years. Children are born scientists, and, you know, to the same extent they're born artists, and they have those things killed in them, that to the degree that you know, the scientific method isn't formalized in children, but children are always looking to understand their world, to see patterns, to recognize patterns, and to try to understand what those patterns mean and how they came to be and why they came to be, just like you said. And the modern educational system, at least in the United States, does an extraordinary job of making sure that such unwieldy questions as "but why" don't persist long in classrooms.
It's so worrying. It reminds me of when I was paying my way through my professional training. I worked in a law firm and I managed pro bono and community investment programs. So, you know, getting lawyers to do nice things for free. And
it was challenging.
Yes, it was a little. But every year we did an in-house charity quiz. And, you know, so the different departments pay their entry fees, and we had one of the lawyers pull together some questions, and it was just a, you know, fun night. And there was no prize, there was no, you know, only the glory of boasting about it the next day, but there were no clients there, nobody would see. And I remember going around the tables during the evening and seeing one of the newly qualified lawyers looking up the answers on his BlackBerry. And I just thought, isn't this astonishing? You know, this is a very low stakes event. It's for charity, it's in-house, there's no pride and there's no shame. Yet the need to win, or the need to be the best one or the right one, trumps the enjoyment of the event and the process and the whole point of just seeing what you know. And just kind of being there.
Oh, that's extraordinary. But, I mean, that's such a great anecdote. And so on these field trips that I used to run, one of the reasons to do them, in addition to explicitly building community and also to, you know, teach some field methods and some, you know, behavior and such, which was usually what I was teaching on these field trips, was to go to places, and this was becoming more and more difficult over time, of course, but I began teaching at the college level in 2002, to go to places with no access to the outside world, right, with no cell service and no internet. And and by, I guess, my last long field trip in Ecuador for 11 weeks in 2016, you know, most of Ecuador, of course, has Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi, as they pronounce it there, but not the Amazon, right? There's still places deep in the Amazon where there isn't any, and it is so. You know, we would be at various field sites for a week or so, and, you know, I always spent a long time talking to students in advance about what this might feel like to them, and that, you know, ask them to think about what they thought it would feel like in advance. And also to try to take careful note of how it actually felt and what their actual experience of effectively going through withdrawal from, you know, this story is more about the access to information, but of course also withdrawal from social media was maybe the more acute thing to show up on the horizon when people were suddenly cut off from that electronic tether. Mm-hmm. But what being in a place with a college program, you know, a bunch of smart young people, without the ability to ask Google, it prompted a realization of how dependent we are. And it also allowed us to actually really do the thing that we would talk about, you know, in class back on campus, which was, okay, yes, you could look that up, but if you couldn't, how would you know? Like, how would you begin to answer the question of, you know, why does a full moon start to become unfull from one side rather than the other? You know, what exactly are, what exactly are the equinoxes and solstices, which are an easy one if you were doing the kind of work that we were doing, but it's amazing how many students don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And can you put together a model of your world? Like in that case, literally a model of the solar system, mm-hmm. and the Earth's position in it and its tilt and such that you can understand what these real, you know, not socially constructed, but real astronomical phenomena are, or do you need to use Google to get to an answer? Mm. And maybe even more interesting yet than the information is when you have derived the answer yourself, certainly with people, like, mm. but in a group without help of some anonymous source that is off-site and that you will never meet, but in conversation with other people, when you have figured something out, does that information in fact stick with you longer than if you just looked it up? Of course it does, right? Like, there's just no doubt at all that the information that you figure out how to derive through logic and through conversation actually stays with you, and then you can use that to help build a more and more complete sort of mental architecture for yourself. Whereas when you Google something, it's in, it's out, it slides away, and it's fast food information. Mm. It's that kind of diet rather than sitting at table and sharing long conversations over home cooked meals. I think there really is a good analogy there.
Yeah. It really makes me wonder about, because, you know, Instagram's only 10 years old and maybe Twitter a little bit older, but, you know, it's not been around very long. We don't really know the effect that these sorts of media are having on our minds and on young people's minds, I think, in particular. I'm seeing little tiny anecdotes. So the shift in my practice over the last 5 years, maybe, is that barely anyone walks into a therapy room without their phone now. Whereas the therapy room of old used to be, you know, it's a kind of sacred space. It's just you and your therapist and your thoughts and the conversation that emerges between the two of you. And now the phone is there and it kind of sits either on the table or certainly within arm's reach. And
do you, I mean, maybe you don't want to answer this, but do you have them turn it off, or do people sometimes use it during session? It does seem like a third thing in the room, a third conscious at some level.
I think it really is. And it really depends. And I think actually it's something that therapy is really going to have to tackle more seriously. I think certainly the older vanguard will maybe ask people to leave it outside. I certainly, there was a bit of research that came out of Korea, I think, that said that young people are seeing their phones as an extension of themselves, such that when it was taken away from them, they felt bereaved, as if, you know, as if they'd lost their limbs. And I think there's something that we really need to understand.
It is extraordinary. And I know, you know, people like us will sound like Luddites to the true believers, some of whom were older at least than you, maybe even than me, but the this is where we're going anyway, and this will actually help us become more than human, superhuman argument that's coming out of, you know, some parts of Silicon Valley and other tech centers, gives me the willies.
No, me too. And I it makes me worried, and not just wonder, but worried about our capacity to just be with our own thoughts. And I worry about what that says for creativity, because creativity comes out of a quiet mind, for self-knowledge and self-understanding, because that's about introspection and not having your own thoughts crowded out with information from the outside. But I mean, what do you have any thoughts on that?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oh, yes. So many things. Absolutely. So, again, something I used to do in my college programs that I taught, usually the very first day, but almost always the very first week, I would give an assignment which was mostly designed to help students learn how to observe without interpretation. Is observe mm-hmm. without interpretation, and from those observations generate hypotheses and predictions. And so, you know, just empirically, what is it like to try to discern pattern in the universe, and what would a testable hypothesis look like, and what would a test look like? And it was a field exercise that I borrowed and changed a bit from something that was done to me when I was a graduate student that was originally emerged from something that the Organization for Tropical Studies, a terrific organization that runs a bunch of graduate work for basically students in tropical biology in the U.S., mostly in the U.S., although it's international, I think. My version of this 20 questions exercise was I would take all my students outside, depending on where we were, maybe you know, somewhere in the state of Washington usually, but once I did it in Panama, once in Ecuador, and, you know, sometimes other places, take them all out and have told them in advance, bring nothing, please bring nothing except your notebook, your field notebook, and a pen or a pencil, and, you know, a water bottle if you like, and enough clothes such that you can be comfortable outside in whatever the weather is doing right now for 2 hours. And, you know, I didn't do this in the pouring rain or when it was bitterly cold out. I wasn't
trying to, torture session.
Right. And I would drop them one at a time within earshot of each other, but out of eyeshot, not that that's a word, but, you know, not within visual range of one another, and as far away from each other as I could get. But I would, you know, if I had 25 students, I would do it. If I had 50, I would have my co-faculty take half the students in a different direction and drop them along a trail or along a coastline or, you know, depending on what kind of habitat we were in. And I would, you know, find a spot for each of them as they're, you know, this long line of people snaking through the woods usually. I say, okay, you know, you go there. I'll be back for you in 2 hours. Find a spot, settle down, don't move. Like, really, don't go anywhere. And sit there, and ultimately what I want you to start writing down is any observations that you make of what you're seeing around you. And for the purposes of this exercise, I said, try to make the observations about what's going on outside of your head rather than inside of your head. But know that for a very long time, and maybe 2 hours won't be enough to quiet this down, but for most people it was at least enough to begin to quiet down the internal narrative of, what the hell is this? I'm so bored. I'm hungry. I wish I had coffee. What am I doing tonight? What happened last night? Like, you know, all of that chatter that, you know, if you've done this, if you've spent time in the field, meaning for me, the tropical rainforest.
Literal field.
Literal field. You know, or if you've meditated, I think, you know, or, you know, a number of kinds of sort of flow states, to use an increasingly popular term now, can help you achieve a state, can help you get to a place where that chatter actually does go away. But increasingly we don't even create the spaces for ourselves to do so. And so, you know, many students in advance of this assignment would say, oh, come on, this is a waste of time. And even most of them, I think, wouldn't say it to me, but I could tell from the eye rolls and such. And some would say, I've done that. I'd say, okay, good. Then you've done this, and we're going to do it again, because it's actually new every single time. You can learn from this experience, and you know, not only about, you know, the questions that I hope you bring back, that then in the second half of the assignment, we will spend time in small groups and as a whole class talking about some, you know, choice observations and questions that you, that each of you had, and what the hypothesis might be, you know, how you could turn that question into a hypothesis and how you might test that hypothesis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it went forward from the field part of the experience, but what I saw nearly always, you know, and I would promise them, look, I won't lose you. I won't forget you. I will come back for you. Mm-hmm. And I used to be able to say I never, ever left anyone behind. But there, at the very end of my teaching, there was one student who had fallen asleep. And when I was climbing up to a rock, and he had fallen asleep, and I didn't know exactly where he was. And he never came when I was calling for him. And he, you know, wandered back down about 2 hours later while we were in discussion after lunch. It's like, I'm so glad to see you. Where were you?
I'm glad you're okay.
Other than that, you know, we were fine. He was he was amused that he'd fallen asleep and hadn't heard me, but also slightly alarmed that I had in fact left him up there. But you know, other than that, you know, people had the confidence that I'm not going to forget you. I'm, you know, taking notes. I know who's where, and I'll come back for you in 2 hours. Which means that you can, unlike in pretty much the rest of your life, afford to not think about time passing. You can just sit and watch. And try to detach yourself from the stuff going through your head, and you know, watch as hopefully it gets quieter and less frequent and softer over time. And then by, you know, some amount of time into this 2 hours, you will begin to be able to hear the birds rustling around in the bushes next to you, and see the color of the sky changing through the trees, and smell the wetness of the earth, and maybe feel, you know, crumpling leaves underneath your fingers or the moss that you might be sitting on. And those observations, that sort of bringing back to one's own body, is to me part of what it is to be fully human. And this idea of, you know, phone as additional limb, you know, terrifies me, because I think it points to exactly the opposite thing that is happening. We are becoming more and more dissociated from our bodies rather than more integrated with our bodies.
Yeah. No, you speak about it so evocatively. Is it, I'm assuming yes, but was it important to do this exercise out in nature as opposed to in the classroom? Was there something specific about that that you wanted your students to experience?
Yes. I would say there were two things, but one of them is a lot of things in and of itself. One of them was I needed them not to be able to see each other. They needed to, you know, I couldn't, with that many students, I couldn't ever, you know, the logistics just didn't allow for actually putting people so far apart from one another that they were really completely alone. But not being within visual range of one another and having been told not to make noise, they could feel like they were alone, even if they knew that there were 24 other people somewhere out there in the forest. And, you know, I spread them out along a line and clustered them in a group. So, you know, it was somewhat alone, and no one, you know, no one earlier on the line knew where the people later on down the line were. So you really didn't necessarily know where anyone was. And so in a classroom, you can ask people to try to imagine that there aren't other people in the room. But, you know, and this actually relates to the fieldwork that I did myself and that I was teaching to students once we got a little bit farther into it, was very explicitly animal behavior. Like, how is it that we observe animals with as little interpretation as possible, such that we can then formulate hypotheses and, you know, and such that we can then do observations in which we're testing those hypotheses, wherein we are not, say, watching, in my case, two poison frogs wrestle with one another, but wrestle, believe it or not, but wrestle, or like wrestle puts an image into your head right away. Right? Like you have some sense of what that is, and it might be even more ridiculous than you think, because these guys really do go at it. They're tiny, little, brightly colored, aggressive poison frogs. I I came to, I'm quite confident at this point, understand what the frogs were doing. But when I first saw it, how is it that you write, you know, wrestle or fight, even worse, without using those words, which are so loaded with connotation that as soon as you see it as a human being using language, you have a sense of what it means. So how do you write what you see as opposed to what you think it means? And that is so much harder to do if there's even any other human being around. Yes. So when I would do field work, I often had first Latin America and then Madagascar, I often had a field assistant on my extended field trips with me. So I, you know, spent 5 months in Madagascar, and I had a wonderful young, actually English woman with me. And we would both, in the afternoons, we'd go out into the field together to run experiments. But when we were actually doing the focal observations for just, you know, the baseline, what is it? What is the ethogram for these frogs? What is it that these guys are doing? Because no one has ever asked the question before. No one had ever at that point just spent time watching these animals to figure out what they were doing and what their social system looked like and if they were territorial and, you know, what kind of parental care they had, which turns out they did. We never went together. You know, we marked separate populations of frogs together, and then we would go to totally different places on this little tiny island off the coast of Madagascar where I was working, and sit completely alone every morning for, depending on the weather, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. And when I tried to train her, for instance, or my other field assistant on a different field trip, on a different field season, how to do this work, I could describe it and I could be out there in the field with them, but there was just almost no way to do it with another human being there. There was something about the consciousness of another human being that intrudes upon your ability to try not to be in social brain and try to be in nature brain. In, I'm trying to figure out now what these other organisms are doing, but as much as I don't want to be signaling or communicating with this other human, I'm human, and that's what I'm doing. So that's one, that's a long answer to, I think, maybe the simpler thing you asked, which was, could you do it in a classroom? I mean, I think you could modify it and do it in a classroom, but that's one big reason that it would be tough, because you have all these other brains around you. And I think those of us who can completely forget or obliterate the presence of other human beings around us and be in our own heads are also becoming somewhat less human. Like that's a failing rather than a skill that I think is particularly honorable. And then the at some level simpler, but it would be harder to explain more fully, answer is, this was about observing, you know, in my case, I was wanting students to learn how to observe nature, which is so complex and apparently chaotic, but with some exceptions. You know, hurricanes are a lot of chaos, but, you know, I wasn't sending students out during hurricanes, and they were able, you know, there was order there, and I wanted them to try to learn to find the order in the complexity. And human-made systems, such as a classroom, are their own kind of fascinating, but they've controlled for a lot of the chaos, and they've got a whole lot more that is a human construct that was not my main focus of what I was trying to teach them how to discern.
And what was the students' responses? Like, how did they come out of this exercise?
It was, they loved it, I think. You know, I'm thinking back now, I always want to, okay, is there anyone who I know was really dismayed by it or just got nothing out of it, I guess? I don't think that taking the first half of the exercise, the 2 hours in the field alone, writing out questions that come to you, I don't think anyone was unmoved. There were different levels of moved, to be sure. But I heard from many every time I did it, which was usually a couple times a year over the course of, you know, 1.5 decades, that people were surprised to be tuned in at that level to what was going on in their heads, and then grateful as they could watch the voices, you know, without there being anything abnormal about the voices in our heads. You know, those voices sort of start to get quieter and quieter, and for many students, they said to me, it became something they wanted to seek out which I felt like that was extraordinary value, sort of a collateral benefit of doing this with students. And then, you know, the second half of the exercise, which depending on the program and the timing, either happened on the afternoon of the same day or the next day. The second part of the exercise therefore went a little bit differently if people had time to sleep on it. But the second part was social, explicitly social, right? You're going to get together in small groups, and each of you is going to choose your favorite question from your list, and you're each going to choose someone else in your group's, a question from someone else in your group that is your favorite of theirs. And then you're going to take those 8 or 10 questions, depending on the size of the group, and you're really going to try to drill down and figure out, like, is this a question that could be posed for answer scientifically? Like, is it that kind of question at all? And if so, how would you categorize it? You know, is it a what question that is just like a, you know, what's the name of this? Or, you know, something really kind of formulaic that may also be actually a human construct in terms of the answer. Like, what do we call it? Sure. Well, what do we call it is, is simply what we've named it. But what is it part of is not a human construct. You know, like, I was watching these Stellar's Jays. I wonder if jays and crows are similar somehow. Mm-hmm. Well, there are scientific ways into that, and one of them is phylogenetically. Crows and jays are really closely related to each other. They're in the same family of birds, and so, you know, from a behavioral standpoint, we can try to begin to understand if some of the extraordinary, like, cognitive capacities and tool making and sort of theory of mind that you see in crows and jays are actually there at, like, the base of the corvid tree, as it were, corvids being the crows and jays, or are those new innovations in both of their cases? So, you know, trying to begin to untangle those sorts of questions is part of the fun. But then we come back together with, depending on the size of the class, you know, 5 groups or 10 groups of these students, and I've had them write up some of their favorite questions and hypotheses and tests on big pieces of paper, and they've hung them around the room, and we go around and have each group talk through with the class at least one of the questions that they've worked up, and it gets heated. Like, people really, really feel in themselves that they have come to really want their hypothesis to be true, and they will defend it fiercely. And as I said, I did this in the beginning of classes, so mostly these were not students who yet knew each other very well, and they were willing to be, you know, I never allowed meanness, but I did allow the raising of voices if it was in the spirit of, you know, engagement. Mm-hmm. And no, this, I really feel this. This is what I feel. Like, no, you're wrong. This is why. That kind of heat without anger, and you know, owning the fact that you have come to fiercely want to defend a hypothesis, even when the entire, you know, one of the entire points of the exercise is to reveal that you should try to at all times be falsifying your hypothesis. Mm-hmm. That is an extraordinary thing for people to experience in real time, to experience watching their peers go through it. And so they would come out of that second part energized and amused. And, you know, there was always a lot of laughter and noise and excitement. And I think I'm not misreading this. And, you know, certainly some rooms worked better than others, as will always be the case. But the best ones of these, we emerged from 3 or 4 hours of that second part of that exercise, feeling like not only are there lots of ways to carefully and rigorously and compassionately answer questions that are out there, but there are still so many amazing questions that haven't been answered. Like, there are new things under the sun. We have not done it all. And that means, especially for young people, feeling often like it's all been done. Right? That this gave them hope that they could actually make a difference, actually.
Well, you raised so many interesting ideas in there. Like, so the first thing that struck me was, and I think you said it started to get more difficult to do this later on in your teaching, was how easy it would be now to get permission to go and drop your students off along a stream somewhere in the Amazon for 2 hours.
It's an impossible question to know. If I were still at Evergreen teaching there, I would be ramping up to do another, I would be in the middle of the study abroad program right now with plans to go back in January for another, you know, 10 or 12 week trip. And I've been thinking about that a lot this year. How would that look different now with both, you know, with colleges having a very different approach to risk for legal reasons.
Absolutely.
That's changing. And then students feeling more empowered to say, I won't do that because it makes me feel unsafe. You know, my very explicit philosophy from long before, you know, you said 5 years or so ago is when it started to feel like your practice was changing, like people were always coming in with their phones and such. And that is about the time period, like 2013-14, that, for instance, Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt have talked about in their new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, in which they, you know, they're trying to figure out, and I think they do so brilliantly, frankly, sort of what is it that has changed. You know, it's not the so-called millennials so much that are really have a different attitude about learning and about campus and about how to engage with one another, but it's the people coming up behind them. And you know, in part it is certainly the different kind of technology that the younger generation has been largely raised with. I think for me, I could not imagine continuing to teach students in an environment in which I was being told that I needed to keep them safe by the standards of some either bureaucracy or the students themselves, whom I was trying to teach and, you know, educate into becoming more appropriately confident and less risk averse in both, you know, to some degree physical, but certainly metaphorical space. That if I was being told that I was hamstrung and couldn't do those things, my feeling would be, well, then the whole exercise is pointless. I will find other ways to try to teach this, and it won't be in the confines of a classroom. And in fact, I think that's part of what has happened.
Yeah, because it touches both parts of that exercise, I think, touch on different aspects of risk. You know, there's the physical safety issues of, you know, where am I going to be for 2 hours? Will you come back for me? Someone going to come and carry me away? But then there's the intellectual and the emotional risk of debate and of having your ideas challenged by your peers in an open forum where you can all see each other, you know each other's thoughts and beliefs, and you put yourself in a position to be told you're wrong or that doesn't make any sense. And well, certainly for me, this is the nature of life. You know, that life is risky, and it puts me in mind of when people talk about relationships, and obviously relationship issues come up quite a lot, and we want to have a kind of a set of relationships or an experience of love that is without risk. You know, we want to be sure, we want to be absolute that our partner is our partner, or that, you know, they'll never look elsewhere, or that they'll never leave us, and we can happily, safely and confidently love them and nothing will ever go wrong. And I think that kind of wish generalizes into other areas as well, and that part of my job, but also I think part of helping people in general, is to understand that life is this kind of full contact sport, isn't it? There is nothing, and to think about something like love, like you cannot really love without vulnerability and without being willing to engage with that risk. And you have to make a cost benefit analysis, and whether the experience of love, of deep love, or of any deep emotion or any deep engagement, you know, it might be in science or in your career, in your field, following a dream, that none of that happens without an inherent aspect of risk.
Absolutely. I think somehow there is, at least in popular culture, no good model for this that is that is like a, at least a formalized model that is pushing back against the ideology of safe spaces. And so, you know, enough so that even early in our conversation today, I think I tempered talking about safety, because it feels like it's a concept that is absolutely necessary, and yet it's been co-opted. That the kind of safety that people are asking for on college campuses and increasingly elsewhere actually looks like danger to me. Mm. Like, actually may feel in the moment like, because there is no pressure from anything that you find inconvenient or uncomfortable or disagreeable, you feel like you're in a safe cocoon. But that does render you weaker. That, you know, that does render you less capable of going out into the world and challenging and being challenged. Like, you will not be able to be as functional if it's that cocoon that you seek. And that is not in any way to suggest that there's not real trauma out there, and that especially, you know, the sooner after, the more acute trauma there is, that people often will really actually need to be protected in many ways. On the other hand, being able to fully experience, you know, including bodily, including viscerally, your own reactions to trauma, if that is in fact what has happened to you, and then to go out into the world and be present and be as strong as you can be and not give yourself a hard time when you do fail or you do find yourself being weak or you do find yourself wanting to retreat, that's the way to move forward and to become your best possible self. So, you know, these safe spaces seem to me, and, you know, I hope originally with the best intentions, although I don't think they're being wielded with the best intentions an awful lot anymore. But I want to believe that originally they emerged out of a real sense that this was best, that, you know, creating safe spaces for people that protected them from everything that they disagreed with was a good thing. But it strikes me very, very strongly as exactly the opposite of what people need.
Well, I feel like I need to make an apology on behalf of psychology, because I feel like I think psychology to an extent and sociology more so is kind of responsible for some of this, in as far as when I was training, and that was 15 years ago, all of these words, things like, you know, safety, safe space, triggering, had very specific meanings. So when we were talking about being careful about trigger words, for example, we were very specifically being taught and thinking about working with people with PTSD and helping them to understand what aspects of the environment might trigger a flashback for them or some sort of anxious episode. You know, they had very, very specific psychological meanings in terms of treatment and diagnoses. And that was the context in which I understood them and learned about them. So it's been this strange transformation for me over the years to see them transformed and overgeneralized, I think, into anything that might make you feel any mild discomfort as a trigger, and anywhere that you might be challenged on your position or your ideas as being unsafe. And so I feel, you know, a little bit conflicted, because I feel like there is value in these words. And I do want people to feel safe to say what they want without fear of kind of personal or ad hominem attacks. But I don't want people to feel like, because they have a particular feeling, that their feeling trumps objective reality or the validity of somebody else's position by virtue of them feeling it.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I do, from my perspective, not having looked into the history, it looks like it's at least been more co-opted by sociology. That I would I would give psychology a bit more of a break than sociology on this.
Thanks.
Yeah, that there is a co-option for sure, as you say, and then a conflation, and, you know, this actually is so much of the confusion these days, and it's not all of it by any means, but is there, there was a good idea. There was a kernel of a good idea. I'm not convinced that the sort of trigger trigger words is a good idea. I'm not saying I think it's not. I'm just not convinced.
Sure.
But it might be. But certainly there are many good ideas out there originally that become blown into something that are insane. Mm-hmm. You know, that just don't make any sense. And then those are the ones that, because they are unnuanced and explosive and they get people's attention, that grab the public's attention.
Mm.
So the use of safe spaces and trigger warnings, I guess, you know, if it had just stayed within, you know, maybe psych, but certainly sociology, and sociology had, you know, kept to itself more or less, we wouldn't be having at least some part of the problems that you know, college campuses, for instance, and increasingly K-12 and increasingly out in the corporate world are having, wherein now everyone is expected to provide for people who can claim at any moment that they need a safe space.
Mm.
And that feels like running away from becoming strong and anti-fragile rather than what it is advertised as, which is that this is what you need in order to be whole.
Mm. Yeah, and certainly from my perspective, one of my big worries is what it does to our capacity to think. And that sounds like maybe a kind of grand statement, but I feel like if you progress ideas through debate, I don't think there's a much better way to be able to progress ideas. But if you've gotten to a position where you've said, well, you're not allowed to say that, and maybe even as far as you're not allowed to think that, and you're certainly not allowed to sit and argue with someone else about their position, then I'm not sure what hope we have to be able to progress ideas or come to a position, if not of compromise, but at least, you know, good faith interlocution. You know, I will willingly sit here and I am in good faith going to be open to listening to you, not just hearing you, but listening to you. I might even go as far as to say I'm willing to change my mind, but I'm willing to make some sort of compromise of my position in order for us to make some progress on this important issue. And if we can't disagree with each other, I'm worried, Heather.
I'm exactly with you, so we're in agreement. But I mean, I think it's the mark of an ideologue, right? That if you're in total agreement with someone else, what are the odds that you each, using first principles, came to exactly the same conclusions across a wide range of diverse topics? You know, if you're in complete agreement with someone on some topics, or even many topics, great, right? That is how we tend to find our groups, you know, our friends and our affiliations. But if you're in exact agreement across the board, probably you both got those thoughts, got those ideas from some shared source. Like that's kind of just me using parsimony here, right? This is Occam's razor, like the simplest explanation for how did you guys both end up with exactly the same opinions on all of these things. I don't think you generated those opinions on your own. You know, I think you got those opinions from a single other source. And that's consistent too with when you try to engage someone who seems to sound like many, many other people on a topic and is quite adamant and vociferous about it. They are less willing to listen, as you say, rather than as opposed to hear, and less willing to be movable. And it often can feel like you're just waiting for me to stop talking so that you can continue with what you were saying before I started talking.
Mm.
So
maybe we can try to end this on a more hopeful note. What do you think is needed? Actually, after that little interaction I had on social media, what I was surprised to find was that people from that person's page sent me private messages saying, thank you for saying something. I was, you know, I was too afraid to say something because I got shut down, but, you know, I don't agree with everything they say. And that was startling for me, because part of this person's approach is to be, you know, empowering and all encompassing and accepting of everybody's position, but clearly not everybody in their audience felt like that. And it was important for these people that wrote to me that someone had kind of put their head above the parapet. So maybe there's something in that.
There very much is. And you know, increasingly we're hearing people talk about the necessity of being courageous when it feels like everyone feels a different way. Sure. And if you are convinced, if you have your convictions and you say a thing that you know is going against the norm, in this climate, you can expect to be yelled at and perhaps bullied and perhaps, you know, perhaps worse. And you should still do that if you are convinced of the virtue of your position, regardless of whether or not you are in fact the only person who believes it, because most things that are understood to be true are understood to be true first by one person, right? But maybe to help make it easier for people, in every one of these situations that I've heard about and that I've lived, what is actually going on behind the scenes is every time that you put your head above the parapet, as you say, there is an outrage, an outcry that is public and appears to be unanimous against you. Mm-hmm. And behind the scenes, many people show up and say, shh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I can't do it because, and almost everyone has a reason that sounds good. And mm-hmm. some of them are, and some of them I would say aren't. Mm-hmm. And if they only knew how many of them were out there feeling like I'm self-censoring because I'm one of a tiny handful of people who feels the way I do, if they knew that actually there are many people and it's growing, and that even the many people who are currently buying in to the orthodoxy of righteous indignation and denial of science and reality, even many of those people actually, if engaged in good faith with care, could begin to be swayed that actually conversation, you know, dialectic in which we're trying to figure out what is true rather than convince one another of a position, regardless of whether it is true, is the best way forward. I am compelled that this is both what we need and that it's possible, and that most people look at what happens when you do stand up, look at the, you know, what happened to you, part of it could be seen online, presumably. What happened at Evergreen, where I was, you know, very public. And most people look at that and say, I could never survive being on the other side of that. Like, that looks horrible. Mm-hmm. That looks horrifying. And I can't afford to lose my job. I can't afford, you know, whatever it is. Or I don't feel like I'm resilient enough to survive psychologically with being harassed in that way. And I would say, I'll bet you could say too, although I'd love to hear it in your words, you know what, not only is it survivable, but it's actually empowering. Mm. Because you get out the other side and you go, wait a minute, A, the things that are being said about me are wrong. Like, I'm okay, let me check. Nope, not true. I have internalized misogyny and I'm not a racist and a transphobe and all of these crazy words that people fling around now, right? More to the point, like, okay, that's not true and I know that, but actually now, what are they going to call me now? Like, now I can stand up and say truth, and they've already used their weapons because they're not very good. You know, they're just words that, and, you know, in almost all of these cases are being used uncarefully and falsely. And once you get through that, you actually realize that being in this position of being on the other side of the looking glass is how I've been talking about it. Once you go through the looking glass and you look back on the other side, you go, oh, this is actually better anyway. Mm. And so I would encourage people to imagine what it might be like to go through the looking glass, to stick your head above the parapet, to, you know, mix as many metaphors as I can. Go through the looking glass, stick your head above the parapet, when it feels important to you to do so. And don't take the hatred and the bile that comes your way if it does personally. Mm-hmm. Watch what happens and see if you don't walk out the other side feeling more like you're on solid real ground, like you're more attached to reality and truth now, and also a tremendously wonderful community of people who have done the same thing afterwards.
Heather, that is magnificent.
Thank you so much
for that. Oh, I didn't even get to ask you all my questions about evolutionary biology. I might just send those to you separately.
Oh, this has been so wonderful. I've loved talking to you.
And that's it. Huge thanks again to Heather for making the time to speak with me. You can follow her on Twitter at Heather E. Heying. That's HEATHERE HEYING. Or find her on heatherheying.com. If you like thoughtful, reasoned, and considered debate, I would really recommend following and supporting her work. In upcoming episodes, I speak to one of the founders of nutritional psychiatry and get to grips with anger, but not at the same time. There's some really good stuff coming up, so do make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any of the future episodes. That just leaves me to thank you very much for listening, and until next time, I wish you the very best of health.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.